You know, I've dabbled in the world of psychedelics a little bit. Okay. I've taken mushrooms a few times, maybe five times. And luckily, all of my experiences have been really good. I've taken mushrooms a few times at a party, which I've enjoyed a lot, because every time I've taken mushrooms at a party, I've weirdly just felt sharper. And I've felt like a clearer view of the room. You know, socially, it's been fascinating and interesting to analyze everyone in a psychedelic way. Like, I feel like I can read the room more accurately than I ever have before. I feel like I'm seeing clearly for the first time. And my opinions on people sort of change and become weirdly more accurate on mushrooms. So that's been my party mushroom experience. I've dabbled in psychedelics, but I really don't know a lot. And I think it's becoming an increasingly more relevant topic as it's being revealed that it can help with mental health issues. It has therapeutic qualities. And so I'm curious about this. I don't know a lot about it. So I'm going to be interrogating Robin Carhart-Harris today, a pioneer and leading researcher in human neuroscience and psychopharmacology. And he's best known for his groundbreaking work on how psychedelics affect the brain and how they can be used to treat mental health issues. In 2019, he founded the world's first Center for Psychedelic Research at Imperial College London. And there, he oversaw human brain imaging studies with LSD, psilocybin, MDMA, and DMT. Robin has also overseen several clinical trials of psilocybin therapy for disorders including depression, anorexia, and fibromyalgia. Basically, he is all about using psychedelics to help human suffering, improve the quality of people's lives through psychedelics. And, you know, I think a lot of us think of psychedelics and we think of, I don't know, doing shrooms with friends and painting, or doing shrooms at a music festival, or doing LSD at a rave or whatever. Like, we think of psychedelics as being something that is very much recreational and also illegal. It's sort of hard to comprehend in a way, because I feel like we all have such a clear view of what psychedelics are. But today we're going to learn a new definition of psychedelics with the king, this king of psychedelics. He might not like me calling him that. Robin Carhart-Harris. Here he is. This episode is presented by Häagen-Dazs. It's love at first bite with the new Häagen-Dazs Dulce de Leche Bar, featuring rich caramel dulce de leche ice cream, swirled with thick, milky dulce de leche ribbons and dipped in milk chocolate. Indulgent? Yes. The perfect way to treat yourself? Absolutely. Find at retailers nationwide. That's Dazs. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Imagine you find something that you love. Maybe you see your friend wearing a cool t-shirt and you're like, oh, I want that. And then they give you the website and you go onto it and it just doesn't feel quite right. That doesn't make you want to buy that t-shirt. A good website is crucial when it comes to selling your product or a brand. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. It's okay if you don't know the first thing about design. You can choose from professionally curated layouts with the Squarespace blueprint. Squarespace even has AI that can help you kickstart or update your website copy. If you're selling products, Squarespace makes checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment methods. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial and save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain with the code Emma. This episode is brought to you by Walmart. I love the springtime. It's a great chance to refresh your wardrobe, home, or beauty routine. And you know what? I think you'll find Walmart has some great style finds that won't break the bank. If you want to upgrade your style, they've got clothes. If you want to upgrade your home decor, pick up some fresh new pieces. You can upgrade everything from your fit to your furniture in-store or shop it all on the Walmart app. Shop the latest spring styles at walmart.com/nowtrending. That's walmart.com/nowtrending. Now trending, your style at Walmart.
I think my first question for you is to like fully, I'm just
yeah,
throwing it on you. My first question has to be, what was your first psychedelic experience, if you even have one? Maybe you've never even tried them. Tell me everything.
Right. It's funny that you would ask it that way. Most people say, have you ever tried it? It usually goes that way, not, you know, tell me about your first one.
I want to hear about the first one.
Right, okay. Gosh. I'm just going to share. Yeah. So I was in my teens. I was the summer of 1995. I'm 43 now, so I was 14.
Mm-hmm. Whoa. Yeah. Young. Okay.
Yeah, gosh. And it was the summer holidays, and I was with a couple of friends, and we'd planned it out, and it was LSD, and it was called a golden microdot. And I was in my hometown of Bournemouth, and it all happened there. Yeah, that's where I turned on for the first time.
And was it a good experience, would you say?
No, it was pretty nightmarish.
Yep.
You know, it sort of develops and gets weird and then gets weirder and weirder and weirder. And then I thought I died and I thought I was in hell.
yeah, that's not good, is it?
No. I thought I'd been hit by a car. And,
no.
Yeah. And so my bloodied corpse was probably on the road back there. And that's why I'm feeling this weird. That's the only way I could possibly feel this weird is that I must be dead. And so, yeah, that was probably the peak negativity of the trip. It got better, but...
Good. At least it got better. I know. I've been so lucky that I haven't had a bad experience. I have very few experiences, but I've always done mushrooms. Like, that was my first experience, was with mushrooms, and it was at a party, and it was just a little bit.
Mm.
And that's the only psychedelic experiences I've ever had. It's just a little microdose. Like, not even a microdose. It's like a little more maybe than a microdose at a party. That's all I've done.
That's the better way to do it, for sure. Oh, yeah, you know, within reason and context. But jumping in the deep end like I did was a silly way to do it.
Yeah.
I think people are more, you know, younger people are more clued up about psychedelics these days.
What is the definition of psychedelic? Like, what is it for those who are listening, and even for me, how do you define psychedelics?
So the word itself means soul revealing. If psyche means soul, most literally, the other bit means to reveal or to make visible or manifest, and kind of a poetic term, but coined in reference to psychedelic drugs,
mm-hmm.
even though we apply it to art and music, it started with the drugs,
mm-hmm.
Came on the scene in the 1950s after LSD was discovered in the 1940s. So really, like, at its core, it's referring to what these drugs do to the mind, and that they reveal it, they mm-hmm. open it up. And mm-hmm. so, yeah, that's what the word means. And then, you know, psychedelic drugs are drugs like LSD, magic mushrooms. Psilocybin is the drug in magic mushrooms. You've got DMT and ayahuasca. There's lots of psychedelics. People sometimes lump MDMA, mm-hmm. Molly, ecstasy in with psychedelics. And I think you can kind of get away with that. It's kind of soul revealing in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It has different properties. I'm not sure I'd put that one right at its core. And then maybe ketamine, but not really in my book, but kind of a bit. So
yeah,
there are some that are sort of fringe edge case psychedelics.
Yeah. Do you think you wanted to research psychedelics because of your sort of horrific first experience? Or was your journey to researching psychedelics different? Like, what got you there?
I think it must have been that, you know, started paving the road. But it wasn't obvious by the time I came to being kind of academic and quite different to how I was in my teens. I was just drawn into psychology. So I was really into psychology, trying to understand the mind, I guess, you know, wanting to better understand myself and other people. And then I got really into depth psychology, so psychoanalysis stuff like unconscious mind and the ego and Freudian stuff. And then while doing that, while studying that, I discovered that psychedelics were used in the 50s and 60s in psychoanalytic psychotherapy to reveal the unconscious mind and dissolve the ego. So when I realized that and the penny dropped and I thought about, you know, my trips, it all made sense. And I was like, ah, yes, of course.
Did you have any psychological challenges growing up, maybe that made you interested in how psychedelics can help the mind? Like, was that something that was inspiring to you? Is that something that you maybe felt like, I think a lot of times we fall into our passion out of necessity in a way, you know, it's not always that way, but it kind of was for me. It's like, I need this. I need to do this. Did you have that with psychedelics at all? You know, was it like, maybe you're anxious or maybe you've struggled with depression. Have you struggled with those things? And has that made you more interested in psychedelics as sort of a form of therapy in a way?
Yeah, in a sort of indirect way. So I was an anxious teenager for sure, socially anxious. And so that was the pull to psychology, I think. I was like, what the hell's going on? Like, I don't understand this. This shouldn't be happening in a sense. Like, it's annoying as
well.
So I guess in that sense, I was looking for some answers. I really was.
Yeah.
And so that was the pull into psychology, and it was very strong. Mm-hmm. It was really like only that, you know. I wasn't going to be a professional footballer, that one, by the way, so soccer player. So that was the pull. And then it wasn't obvious to me that psychedelics were helpful for mental health.
Interesting.
Until like I was in the job researching it, in a sense. When I wanted to first research psychedelics, which is in my early 20s, and I'd done my psychoanalysis master's and I was looking for a PhD, and I wanted to do a brain imaging study with LSD. And I took that to someone in the UK and said, you know, this is what I really want to do. But it wasn't because I thought they could be useful in treating mental illness. It was just that I thought that they were really, you know, amazing tools to see into the mind, and that we would get, you know, amazing insights into the nature of the mind and the brain if we did something like this, gave someone LSD and a brain scanner. Mm-hmm. In fact, I couldn't believe that no one had ever done that before. Mm-hmm. You know, it was some way along, probably once we started giving people psilocybin, magic mushrooms, mm-hmm. in a brain scanner, and then they said they felt really good afterwards, despite having magic mushrooms in a brain scanner. And so I started putting things together in terms of the history of magic mushroom use by certain cultures for, you know, visionary medicinal reasons, and then the history with the psychotherapy stuff in the 60s, 50s and 60s. And then we looked at the brain imaging data and saw things that made sense in the context of other treatments for depression.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, we put kind of two and two together and wrote a grant application to do a trial with psilocybin therapy and depression, which ended up being the first trial.
Mm-hmm.
And now we might be a couple of years away from psilocybin being a licensed medicine.
Wow.
Yeah, across the Western world. You know, it's all like little stepping stones forward, different studies. But that was a pretty important milestone, one, was doing that first depression trial with psilocybin, yeah.
I feel like there are so many psychedelic drugs, and it can be easy as somebody who maybe doesn't study it to sort of lump them all in together in a way. What are the key differences between the main psychedelic drugs?
Well, the main classic psychedelics would be drugs like LSD, psilocybin, magic mushrooms, DMT, which is in ayahuasca, but people smoke DMT as well. In our studies, we actually inject it. And then you've got a compound that's sort of weird, but it's probably a classic psychedelic. I mean, they're all weird, but 5-methoxy-DMT, which is identified from these toads quite recently. But anyway, I would say broadly speaking, at least DMT, LSD, psilocybin, those are the classic psychedelics. And they're the ones that might like open the psyche and reveal like, you know, maybe things that you've repressed or overlooked. Or for sure, they're really visually perceptually disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
Like if we were tripping right now, depending on dose, you know, the walls might be moving and swaying and there's like a fractal kind of quality to things, surfaces, and everything's more animated and things can distort, and then you close your eyes and you can have these very vivid, elaborate visions that sort of morph and change, have a kind of dreamlike quality in a sense. So those are the classic psychedelics. You know, historically, some people like to call them hallucinogens.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit misleading because you don't typically see like a little green man just, you know, run through the wall into the room and start dancing
or something.
Right,
it's not random.
It's not random. It's usually things that you're seeing that become distorted. And depending on dose, they can become really distorted.
Yeah.
And drug. And if you close your eyes, sure, you're seeing things that in a sense aren't there, but then they've got to come from somewhere.
Yep.
So they come from the mind.
Yep.
So I would say like revealing things of the mind is really the quintessence of classic psychedelics. And
yep.
That is what the term is saying. And I think that's true. That and the visual side of it. So near neighbor psychedelics like MDMA is more about sensation, positive emotion, like a sense of social, deep social connection. So it's more reliably positive in a sense, MDMA.
Mm-hmm.
It's rarer that it would get dark and scary like classic psychedelics can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why it's often combined with, you know, music listening and stuff and dancing.
Mm-hmm.
But in a psychotherapeutic context, it can allow you to go to dark places without being overwhelmed necessarily.
Mm.
So, for example, in post-traumatic stress disorder, people have been developing MDMA therapy for treating that. So, you know, combat veterans or victims of you know, many types of trauma, severe trauma that cripples them psychologically, they can talk about those experiences under the MDMA where usually they just really couldn't talk about it. You know, they would have overwhelming flashbacks, or they might dissociate. So it's an incredible tool to facilitate psychotherapy in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
And with MDMA, people generally can talk. You know, maybe with the classic psychedelics, like a big dose of magic mushroom, psilocybin, it's so intense that and weird that like talking is left till later on generally, you know.
Yeah.
In the psychotherapy, that happens later on. Yeah. And then there's others like ketamine is more of a dissociative. I mean, it's defined that way as a dissociative anesthetic. If you give too much, it becomes an anesthetic and knocks you out.
Yeah.
It's dangerous that way. And it is used as an anesthetic in certain contexts, but it's less emotional in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's so reliably revealing of the psyche like the classic psychedelics.
Mm-hmm.
With the classic psychedelics in psychedelic therapy, there's often a lot of tears. And actually, it's a funny thing to say, but when people are crying in the trials, we generally know it's working, which is weird.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a kind of catharsis, there's a release of this pent-up emotion. And we think that's, you know, part of the healing.
Absolutely.
Action, yeah.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. Take a minute to check your social battery. How's it doing? Does the thought of social events make you feel excited or exhausted? To be honest, my social battery is horrible right now. I am running on empty. I want to be alone for a whole week straight and see no one and talk to no one. I think I've overbooked myself a little bit. And so I'm feeling very drained. And hey, maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need more time alone. Either way, therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery, because a full battery is the key to a full life. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/anything today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/anything. This episode is brought to you by Bumble. When you want someone compatible, start the search on Bumble. It has the features you need to find exactly what you're looking for, like a 6-foot Aquarius who likes rock climbing and also wants kids, or a runner with a penchant for poetry who loves dogs and wants a serious connection. We know you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Download Bumble today. So do these different drugs, when they impact the brain, do they impact the brain differently? Like, do mushrooms impact the brain differently than LSD? Mm. Or is it sort of like, I'm assuming they must be different because they're all sort of used for different things? Or is it that, yeah, like, what is the difference on a technical level inside of the brain? Like, if you were to look at a scan of the brain, it's like, are different areas lighting up? What's the difference?
Yeah. So at the lowest level, sort of molecular level, yeah, the drugs look a bit different, and that relates to how they stick to stuff in the brain, and they stick to different stuff. And when they stick, they do different things as well. Mm-hmm. So drugs like LSD and psilocybin are actually quite similar,
mm-hmm.
and they look a lot like a brain chemical called serotonin, which is swimming around our brains right now. And most of it's actually in our guts, but in the brain, it does some important things. It's involved in a lot of different things, sleep, mood, and we think especially mood probably. And so there are certain sort of signaling proteins in the brain that serotonin would bind to and mm-hmm. stimulate. And these drugs do that. LSD, psilocybin, because they look like serotonin, they're sort of like serotonin imposters, and they'll stick to these, they're called serotonin receptors. These proteins that will kind of tune brain function in different ways. Mm-hmm. And there's one in particular, it's called the serotonin 2A receptor, that the classic psychedelics stick to, and then they do their thing there. And to cut a very technical story short to the gist of it, by stimulating these serotonin 2A receptors, they cause brain activity to become, in a sense, more chaotic. Dysregulated.
Yeah.
So the usual kind of regulated function of our brains and our minds, like right now, being able to talk and stitch things together, have some sense of like assuredness about what's what.
Mm-hmm.
That depends on the regularity, in a sense, of our functioning brains right now. And when they get funky and dysregulated, so does our experience of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the gist of it. There's more to it. That's the sort of breakdown side of things.
Yeah.
But maybe in the breakdown side of things, there's also a release side of things. So stuff that before was constrained can come up more easily.
Yep.
Like emotional circuitry can be let off the leash a little bit, you know, and that can account for the crying and so on. And maybe the insight as well, because memories that were being constrained are now unconstrained and can come up.
So that's sort of what's happening maybe during, while the drug is in your system. But what happens after? You know, do you go completely back to normal at some point? Or like after you do a psychedelic drug, are you forever changed in the brain?
We don't know, but you might be. So this is a recent discovery of mm-hmm. ours. We're just on the cusp of, you know, splashing it to the public. But we gave people their first magic mushroom experience,
mm-hmm.
and we did it in a placebo-controlled way. So first of all, we give them something inert that has no effect, really. It's actually a very low dose of mm-hmm. psilocybin that shouldn't have any action. We scan their brains before all that. We scan their brains after the placebo, and then we give them a whopping dose of psilocybin, their first ever psychedelic experience. And we look in their brains a month after, and we did see some enduring changes. And actually it was in the anatomy of the brain, which is kind of weird and maybe at first a bit scary.
Mm.
And it is a question mark now, is that You know, what if we looked a year later or even longer, would we still see it? Like, is it a permanent change?
Right.
What does the change mean? All these questions, that's kind of classic science, really. It sort of teases you, gives you a little bit, you know.
Yes,
and you've got
yes.
a bunch of other questions. So we have seen this change. What is it? So we look at the cabling of the brain
mm-hmm.
and we look at how that changes, whether it changes at all. We saw that it changed and it changed in a direction which is, it's the opposite direction to what happens in aging and pathologies of aging, like mm-hmm. Alzheimer's. So on that level, it's a good thing. Maybe a good thing, we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a consistent direction to what happens in the brain when you go from being a baby into being an adult.
Mm.
So the fibers are becoming sort of more packed, we think, maybe, but we don't really know. The cables are sort of truer in the direction that they're going in.
Yeah.
They're less sort of diffuse. In fact, that's what it is. It's a diffusivity measure along a long cable that goes from the front of the brain into the middle of the brain.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, let's say somebody has a bunch of mushrooms at home and they eat all of them.
Mm.
It's just a bunch. Yeah. They just eat all of them. Like, what happens? Like, are psychedelics the type of thing that you can OD on? Because it is, to me, like, you know, with other drugs, like, you know, you can very easily OD and just die.
Yeah.
I don't hear about that ever with psychedelics. Can you do that? Like, can you overdo it? And if so, what happens?
Mm.
Or do we not even know that either?
Oh, we do know. We do know because, you know, they say the dose makes the poison. It's true across the board for anything,
true.
Any kind of drug. So you could take too much mushrooms. What would most likely happen is just that you would sort of lose awareness, lose contact with reality completely. You wouldn't really know that you're a human. You certainly wouldn't be able to talk or walk, you know.
Oof.
You probably wouldn't. I don't know of OD through the direct toxicity. I know of a vague case of a heart attack in someone who mm-hmm. was elderly and had cardiac like issues,
yeah.
had a vulnerable heart in the first place. So it's not like, say, fentanyl, where it's far too easy to OD and kills so many people. You know, even alcohol has this small window of where you can be a bit tipsy or drunk to it's pretty dangerous now.
Yep.
And can be fatal. Thankfully, it's quite rare that you're going to OD because of like some organ failure.
Yeah.
Because of psilocybin or some other, you know, toxin, say, probably be more likely to be some other ingredient in the mushrooms than psilocybin.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, nevertheless, if you eat that big plate of mushrooms, like it's not good news. You know, psychologically, it's going to be a wild ride. You might not remember much of it, that too. If you are conscious and online, so to speak, it's going to be just so outlandishly weird that it's probably unpleasant as well.
Have you found that a bad trip can actually be a beneficial one?
Yeah.
Is that like, because I mean, I think a lot of people go into using psychedelics thinking, I hope that this is a good one. You know, like, I hope this is good. I hope that, you know, that I don't see anything bad, that I don't see anything scary. Is it inherently bad to have a bad trip, or could it even be beneficial in some way?
Yeah, it can be beneficial potentially. So, you know, it's not inherently bad. If it's really bad, so bad by severity and bad by duration, like the entirety of the trip was just hellish, that's probably bad news. And that, you know, the lasting impact of that is probably going to be more likely to be negative than positive, or at least not so obviously positive. Mm-hmm. But many trips have the challenge, and often that challenge happens early on, mm-hmm. when things start getting weird and you know, your sense of self starts breaking down, and there's something sort of instinctive that wants to push back on that. Like, I don't like this, I don't want this. Maybe attempts to stop it, and they're kind of futile. And so that resistance can sort of define the struggle. Mm. But what often happens is that there's a sort of almost like a surrender to the struggle. It's like, okay, I'm tripping. You know, let's sort of sink into this and drop into it. And then it very subtly and quickly can change into something that you're like surfing rather than just battling against. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of way we sort of tutor people, in a sense, supervise people when we do the psychedelic therapy, sort of mentor people, is to, you know, we don't dress it up. It can be challenging, and especially early on. But when you feel that, know that your body's safe, that you're being looked after. Mm-hmm. Know that we've seen this before many, many times. We're confident in, you know, the medicine and try and go with the flow a bit. Yeah.
Have you noticed that there's something that can lead to a bad trip? It sounds like sort of fighting it can lead you to a bad experience.
Mm.
You know, is it even clear sort of what makes an experience bad?
Mm.
Is it maybe somebody who has a lot of demons in particular?
Mm.
Or can it kind of just happen to anyone? It's sort of whatever your subconscious decides to do. Like, what do we know what creates a bad trip?
It's not one thing, but we do know that there's a few potential, you know, contributors. One is like simply just taking too much drug.
Mm-hmm.
It's harder to surf something when it's, you know, really, really intense.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, people with a history of adverse life experiences, history of trauma, yeah, there's more dark stuff in there and it can come up. Also, the intentions, if you're sort of trying to take a psychedelic for escapist reasons,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't work that way. You know, it's going to slap you in the face and cause a confrontation rather than an escape. So it's like the inverse of what you were hoping for, you know?
Yeah.
Actually, younger people do seem to be more vulnerable to challenging experiences.
Mm-hmm.
That I think that's true even if you take into account experience with the drugs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a sort of logic to people who are less experienced are more likely to have challenging experiences because those who are more experienced have they've learned a lot, but they've also just simply gone back, you know?
Yep.
And that would be unlikely if, you know, you had a really challenging experience and you closed the door on it. Yeah, into relational things, relationship stuff can be a trigger, life stress.
Interesting.
Yeah. And like situational things, big time, you know, tripping in the wrong place.
Mm.
And sometimes that's hard to predict because you could even be in nature thinking, oh, nature and psychedelics really go well together. And then like the cops show up or what looked like the cops, you know? And so it takes a turn that way. So, you know, that formula isn't always that reliable.
What about microdosing? What is the impact of microdosing on the brain?
On the brain is, yeah, there's been a little bit of work. It seems to do something even when you don't really notice it in the brain, which is quite cool and curious. And that's the sort of idea with microdosing, is that you can sort of cheat the trip in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
It takes so little that you're not tripping, but you're getting something. That's really the idea. And some people really swear by it, you know. Big names, Paul Stamets, at least in my field, Jim Fadiman and like Amanda Fielding, the Beckley Foundation, they're all really like passionate believers in microdosing. And it's tricky because we've done a bit of science there and it hasn't always come through as compelling that it's really doing something. It's hard actually for microdosing to beat placebo in trials.
Well, that's what made me, that's kind of what I was thinking, like about microdosing. It's very trendy in LA, you know, to microdose and whatever every day. but it is, you know, placebo. People overlook placebo.
Mm.
And I've wondered with psychedelics, it's like, if it's not, can it work in the background, or does it have to be sort of a vivid experience in order for it to work, right? Like, is the benefit from the trip itself? Like, does it have to feel like a trip in order for it to do all the things that it does? That, you know, I guess that's sort of been my question, is like,
yeah,
is that trip and that experience the thing that changes the brain?
Yeah, it's a big question. In the field, it's a big question, and there's debate around it. Yeah, I'm of the school of thought that the trip is important, really important, and actually the evidence supports that. So we can measure the trip in a few different ways. We can look at different aspects of its quality. We can look at how strong the emotional breakthrough is, that kind of crying stuff I was talking about earlier, the catharsis.
Mm-hmm.
The mystical type experience is a popular one. What's that? Sort of a sense of transcendence and being at one with things, you know, nature, other people, the world, psychological insight, having insight into yourself and your past that you feel, then feel is helpful.
Mm-hmm.
So these are all things of the trip, of the psychedelic, psyche-revealing, you know, property, core property of the drug. And so to try and cheat that by taking a tiny little dose, I'm not sure it really works. Or there's even ideas that you can cheat it by playing with the molecules and the pharmacology to get an action that isn't a trip, but is therapeutic. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's sort of missing the point, and also isn't really that logical, because the trip in the human data seems to be carrying the response. So, you know, I think microdosing is a bit like trying to bypass some of the psychotherapy aspects of psychedelic therapy through just relying on the drug. And that's the other thing with microdosing, is that it's a more regular use of the drug. It might be a tiny dose, but the idea is to like have a course of taking a psychedelic maybe 3 or 4 times a week for 6 weeks, you know, and that starts to sound a little bit more like a course of an antidepressant, like Prozac or something. To be honest, for people like me, having seen what psychedelic therapy can be in depression and other psychiatric disorders with just 1 or 2 dosing sessions, but the doses are high, but people are very well looked after, and there is that psychotherapeutic support before and after, seeing the life transformations with that approach, I wonder why you would, you know, favor that old model of relying more on a drug rather than just 1 or 2 doses of a drug, and the rest is really the psychotherapy.
Yeah,
I think it's a bit of an attempt to sort of cheat the model, maybe because the model is a little hard to fit into the system.
Totally. Yeah. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Imagine you find something that you love. Maybe you see your friend wearing a cool t-shirt and you're like, oh, I want that. And then they give you the website and you go onto it and it just doesn't feel quite right. That doesn't make you want to buy that t-shirt. A good website is crucial when it comes to selling your product or a brand. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. It's okay if you don't know the first thing about design. You can choose from professionally curated layouts with the Squarespace blueprint. Squarespace even has AI that can help you kickstart or update your website copy. If you're selling products, Squarespace makes checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment methods. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial and save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain with the code Emma. This episode is brought to you by Walmart. I love the springtime. It's a great chance to refresh your wardrobe, home, or beauty routine. And you know what? I think you'll find Walmart has some great style finds that won't break the bank. If you want to upgrade your style, they've got clothes. If you want to upgrade your home decor, pick up some fresh new pieces. You can upgrade everything from your fit to your furniture in store, or shop it all on the Walmart app.
Shop the latest spring styles at walmart.com/nowtrending. That's walmart.com/nowtrending. Now trending, your style at Walmart.
Let's dig into sort of the life-changing effects, you know, psychedelics can have on anxiety and depression. Sort of dig into what you've discovered there.
Gosh, I mean, the transformations are amazing. Often, you know, people claim that the intervention has been life-saving, literally.
Mm-hmm.
They'd say that they probably wouldn't be around anymore through taking their life. We've also done trials in anorexia, and they're, you know, it's the most deadly psychiatric disorder. So life-saving, but in a sense, a different way, although the anorexia can be like a slow suicide in a sense. And then, you know, psychedelic therapy for severe drug and alcohol abuse, again, the intervention can be life-saving. So, yeah, the turnaround is pretty remarkable. And when it's so fast, I mean, I'm talking about the best cases, but mm-hmm. there's a lot of very, very good transformations. And so people understand what, you know, kind of proportions am I talking about. In the depression trials, it's about 2/3 of people, 60-70%
mm-hmm.
will show a significant response.
Wow.
That's better by roughly about 20% on current treatments.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pretty, potentially a pretty significant improvement, I would say, on current treatments by efficacy alone, mm-hmm. how well it works. There's a bunch of other stuff to worry about in a sense, but that's a big one. It's got to work. It's got to work well.
Yes.
So yeah, we have done those trials in depression. Personally, I designed a couple of trials, helped design a third trial that a company has now developed on and are doing what's called a phase 3 trial, which could lead to a license for psilocybin therapy for depression mm-hmm. federally. This isn't some state level ballot initiative or anything. That's happened as well.
Mm-hmm.
But now this is through the medical system, getting psilocybin approved so doctors can give it, basically.
Wow.
And that could be a couple of years away. MDMA could even get a license like that for treating PTSD this year.
Wow.
It's been filed already and is being looked at by the medical regulators here in the US. You know, we're on the cusp of major, like, infrastructure level changes with psychedelics. We won't necessarily notice it overnight, which is a good thing, I think.
Yeah.
It needs to be a sort of incremental change, but like key sort of milestones are about to be reached this year.
So exciting.
Yeah.
Do you think everyone can benefit from psychedelics in some way? You know, do you think that, like, let's take the average person. I mean, being a human comes with challenges. Like, everybody has a little depressive episode, a little anxious episode here and there as a result of what's happening in their lives. Maybe they don't have an ongoing issue. Let's take the average person who has the average ups and downs, but maybe doesn't need to be treated for anything.
Mm.
Would they still benefit from psychedelics in some way? Or do you think that it's not something that should ever be used for everyone, and rather it's more useful when attacking a specific problem?
I don't think we should be prescriptive. Like, you know, I don't know if Timothy Leary really said this, you know, his phrase is turn on, tune in, drop out. And the idea is that he was trying to popularize it so that everyone would take LSD in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be prescriptive like that, but even so, I think most people probably can benefit.
Mm-hmm.
There's no should here. It's just more like could.
Could.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. And you don't have to be suffering from depression where, oh, now it's really obvious that it could benefit you. Yeah, sure, the transformation there could be really dramatic, could be life-saving.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that healthy people can't improve in their life satisfaction and well-being, and they do. We've done those studies and quite reliably and markedly people improve, and there's a, you know, often a nice long tail to it as well, like it lasts.
Do you think maybe for the average person it's beneficial because it's kind of fun?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
yeah, it's kind of fun, but sometimes, you know, like that first trip I was telling you about, it's not always fun.
Yeah.
And you take too much, it's the wrong context. And so, and that's not just me sort of saying, you know, kids don't try this at home. It's just the truth of it. You know, it isn't a walk in the park.
Yeah.
It's a very, you know, weird walk in the park.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of drugs that are hedonic, that just make you feel good. You know, people talk about, oh, let's not be too exceptionalist about psychedelics. I hear that, but I also think they're quite distinct from a lot of drugs. Mm-hmm. In how sort of fundamentally they alter consciousness, and them not being like most drugs, being like obviously fun and sort of recreational.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, they can be fun, and maybe in lower doses, but it can easily, you know, not be fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you used psychedelics to help you in your own life? Like, have you used them maybe as a tool to, I don't know, help you get through a challenging time? Or has that not made sense in your life yet?
Mm. No, it's made sense. I've done that on a few occasions. You know, I think it's best to not to take psychedelics too much. And knowing the research, I know that you don't need to. You know, can be pretty sparing. What does that mean? Like, you know, once a year or a couple of times? Yeah, just more like in medicine, you call it PRN. I think it means like, it stands for pro-renata. And I think it means you take the medicine when you need it. So not like a regular course, but when a symptom emerges, maybe take the medicine.
Yeah.
And that's PRN. So yeah, I've done that and it has been helpful. It's difficult to know how things would have been having not done it, but I think, you know, I didn't do a trial of myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I could tell you as a human in a sort of qualitative way, I think it was beneficial.
Yeah.
Yeah. A couple of times in my life at least.
I feel like a lot of people look at psychedelics as something that is also spiritual.
Mm.
What's your opinion on the spiritual side of psychedelics? You know, a lot of people, I feel like I've heard, especially people taking DMT and feeling like they're having, you know, some sort of experience with maybe God or, you know, something like that. What do you think that is? Where does spirituality and psychedelics meet for you? Mm. Or do you find them to be separate completely?
Mm.
I'm curious your opinion on their connection.
Yeah. Oh, the connection is real and very close and important. Yeah, it's a major aspect of the classic psychedelic experience with, you know, the drugs like LSD, psilocybin, DMT, 5-methoxy-DMT. It's quite dose dependent in a sense, I think, that it can produce these spiritual experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And there are different names people use for them: spiritual experience, mystical type experience, peak experience, which is a bit more humanistic, mm-hmm. little less kind of supernatural in a sense, or potentially supernatural. Unitive experience is one I like because it does get to the core of it, I think, and also mechanistically. I'll lay my cards on the table. I'm not a supernaturalist. Mm-hmm. It's often the case when you're a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
And if ever you were or had that in you, it gets kind of beaten out of you.
Yeah, I can imagine.
For better or worse.
I can imagine.
Of course, I've got to think better. But, you know, maybe actually there can be a sadness to lose sort of magic. But then there's magic in a poetic sense. So it's very real and it's very reliable and a major aspect of the experience. And any attempt to try and, I don't know, scrub it out of this area is just in vain because it's really a core aspect of it. You know, we come back to the term psychedelic, psyche revealing, psyche as soul. And, you know, there's that side of of psychology that talks about insight into yourself and your past and your traumas. And but then there's another side of psychology, you know, Carl Jung, who would talk about insight into what it is to be a being, you know, a human being, and sort of a deeper sort of human shared inheritance, in a sense, that that for me and for him was a spiritual place, how we interrelate and how we relate to the rest of nature, very transcendent. And I think it's that transcendence that is at the core of spirituality, interconnectedness and oneness. And, you know, when you sort of explain it out, you realize it's not a woo-woo thing. And it's a disparaging phrase, but it's not a supernatural thing. It's a very beautiful thing of this, you know, universe. So, yeah, in a curious way, I think psychedelics could help validate spirituality. If it needs that, many people might be challenged by that and say, it doesn't need validating, or you don't need to validate my religion or anything like that. In the cultural domain of science, you certainly do. I mean, I'm not proposing we validate religion, but maybe the core of religion that is the spiritual experience, we could validate, actually, and explain what it is, you know, why those experiences happen. Yeah, and then think about what the insights mean.
I love it. Well, I can't wait to come in one day and help get a little help with my anxiety. I'm a very anxious girl.
Right.
So maybe one day you can do a study on me.
Maybe.
This has been a privilege.
I feel good.
Dad, are you singing to your cereal?
Come on, Ava. Silk almond milk starts the morning on a high note.
Silk almond milk.
With calcium, vitamins A, D, and E.
Feel plenty good.